Sir.
Good to go.
Welcome to the Board of Selectmen special meeting, Bolton Volunteer Fire Department Strategic Plan, Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026, 5 p.m. at the Town Hall and Zoom. So I'd just like to call this meeting to order. And number two is discussion with Manitou, reference the Bolton Volunteer Fire Department Strategic Plan. So as we all know, we've taken on Manitou services, and John is representing Manitou, John Cochran, and he's been doing some research, investigative research, and interviewing people, and we thought it'd be a good idea, we all came together, so we could ask him questions, or I'm sure he's going to start by asking us questions, I think.
Well, we'll see how it goes.
Because that'll stir questions from the board.
Right.
Otherwise, they just, I'm not sure your approach.
Okay, very good. We got the floor now?
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me this afternoon and taking the opportunity to discuss with you this project. A little bit about Manitou. We are an independent consulting firm specializing in fire and emergency services, long-range planning. We've been in business since 1999. Dr. Charles Jennings, who owns the company, he delegated me as being the representative, the front person for the firm on this project. We've done work all over the United States, large cities, small communities, even smaller than Bolton. And we've had great success. We pride ourselves on being non-biased, objective-based. We're not affiliated with any type of special interest or association or anything like that. We're independent. All of us have a very strong background in our field of work. Some of us have worked at the U.S. Fire Administration, National Fire Academy, which is part of the FEMA agency, FEMA family. Myself, I have a background in career fire service. Been doing the consulting work with Dr. Jennings since the firm was founded in 1999. A former city fire chief, and sit on a number of nationally recognized fire department related standards, including those related to small communities and their volunteer fire departments. So our view is this: fire protection emergency services is a locally based service that should be managed and directed at the local level. Though we apply best practices from the fire protection industry, we are a strong believer and supporter of a community-based approach. We don't come in and tell you what you got to do. We'll make a non-biased, objective overview of the community, its fire and related problems, its current fire protection system. And when I say system, I always say it this way: fire defense system. Most of us, when we think of fire protection at the community level, we always think of the fire department. And that makes sense because it's the most recognizable, most noticeable. But there's other aspects within this community, both public and private, that has a lot of influence on how fire protection is provided. I'll give you some real basic, simple examples. This afternoon, I interviewed the building official. 78% of a building code is a fire code. All right. We will be interviewing the fire marshal, community development, land use and zoning. All these kinds of things have some role or play within that fire defense system. And our philosophy is the best way to manage that risk is to prevent the incident from ever occurring to begin with. And if it does, hopefully we can mitigate it so that it's less of an impact on the community. And of course, the final is the emergency response, which is an absolute necessity in providing public fire protection. But we don't just look at measuring your community's fire problem through the windshield of a fire truck. We step outside the fire engine, or what I jokingly call the BRTs, the big red trucks. And we look at it holistically. So our work is going to be focused on intelligence, gaining as much information as we can about your community, and the fire department and its capabilities, its performance. And we will come up with some observations and some recommendations as to what you see in the future as improvements in your fire protection. So the task that we've been given is there's three major things that we've been tasked to look at, focus on, and not limited to these, but we've been tasked to look at the fire department in its staffing, that is the volunteer force. Is the volunteer force strengthened in terms of interest in joining the volunteer fire department? Or what's happening in some parts of the country where volunteerism, not just volunteer fire departments, but volunteerism in general is declining. It's my understanding that yes, you have some challenges here in your community, but the fire chief and talking with the fire chief and some of the staff and the town personnel, you're fortunate that you have an organization that appears at least starting out to have a lot of interest and support from the community. And that goes a long ways. That's a big thing. We always say that if you can hold on to your volunteer fire department, do so as long as you can. They're an asset to the community. They are part of the community. And their services are much needed. So we've been tasked with looking at staffing. We'll look at things such as your stipend program, which we haven't had a chance to look at yet. We'll look at facilities, not from an architectural perspective, but for what I'm going to call a programmatic perspective. Does the facility meet the needs of the community in terms of level and type of service that the fire department provides? And then we'll look at your equipment. Equipment can be categorized or subcategorized into what we call fire apparatus or the fire trucks and all the other accessories and equipment and so forth that go along with the fire department. And then another piece is we've been asked to look at deployment. Put it in simple terms, fire station location. And I can tell you right now, you're such a small community, you're at the crossroads already. In the community, we'll do some mapping, measurement, applying some of the best practices that's recognized within the volunteer fire service. We will do the assessment, which we're just getting started this week. We're here through Friday. Tomorrow will be another member of the team that will join me. And we, as a group, as a team, will go and look at the fire department, look at the community. We drive the town. We look at your maps. We look at your zoning and land use and all that. But we really want to drive the community, the streets, the roads. Look at the properties. Look at some of the things that may be unique to your community that you have. That's the best way we think that we can really do a really truthful assessment. Once we're done, we'll produce our findings. We'll submit it through to the town administrator and the fire chief for y'all's review. Look it over, and then from there we'll develop the master plan, a roadmap, if you will. We'll include short, mid, intermediate, and long-term goals, and all this is be linked in with budget. Budget and finance is a big piece of the pie that we're looking at, and so. That's pretty much it. I would add one other thing. Because you have such a robust automatic aid with bordering towns and their fire departments, we have on our schedule an interview of all the, I think there are six that are actually border against the town of Bolton that they respond to your community. Getting their insight, their input, what they can do, and to augment the Bolton Fire Department is critical when we do our assessment. And that's pretty much it. The final product, we will produce for you a master plan presented to the body when we finalize the project. But there's a lot to do between now and then. So our goal, hopefully, if weather permits, we'll have this done in roughly 4 to 5 months at the most. And I think I pretty much covered everything.
Yes, sir. Start with a simple question.
When you do your tour, do you bring a tour guide with you? Somebody who knows the roads and the trouble spots?
The deputy chief
Matt?
will be taking them
Yeah,
around.
go with you. Okay. Yeah, so and we got that scheduled for in the morning.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make sure you weren't just going out alone.
No, we think that the best way for us to gain the insight is as I said earlier, to actually physically go out there. But we need someone who has the experience and the understanding and knowledge about the community to show us different things.
So you do anything, nothing with traffic though. So the state roads, intersections, where the accidents are, it's not.
What we look at in terms of traffic is one of the benchmarks that we use is the response time criteria that's in a best practice from the National Fire Protection Association. And we take that information and your data and we plot a response time over the network that takes in consideration traffic congestion, street intersections that are controlled and things like that. Does that answer your?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But we take it, we take the we factor in things like low clearance,
Yeah.
maybe a trestle, a train trestle that a ladder truck can't get under.
Right.
All right, things like that. Now you're a very small town, so you may not have as many problems like that, but maybe at grade crossings, railroad crossings, that has a factor. Especially if it's a track that's real busy because you're going to be blocking the access.
The only one we have is a people traffic train. They took the tracks up
Oh, I
and left
see.
it with people.
Okay, it's a trail now.
Still a tricky intersection to navigate.
So
That.
I was kind of asking that question for two reasons, and one is we're trying to get the state to give us a new intersection down at the 384, and I was wondering if any of your findings would be some information that we could use to submit to them,
Support.
and we could just say, hey, these guys did this bad, and it should be fixed.
It possibly could, and I'm not the our GIS mapping guru. That's a question for them, but we do take that in consideration. Matter of fact, we're working on a project right now where on the street map, there's a fire station. It's like, oh, they can do this in 4 minutes, real easy. But when we actually applied the analysis, it showed going west, they're way out there in 4 minutes. Going east, they're only this far because it took in consideration that the historic traffic volume of that stretch of road during most of the year, which is during the school year. And so their response time was impacted in a negative way going east because of the congestion. Now, at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's pretty much smooth sailing, most places, but in those peak demand times, and sometimes we've even done an analysis where when is the traffic peak demand time and when is the call volume peak demand time, and we'll look at those, and sometimes they're right on top of each other, particularly on the EMS side where call volume is just continually going up and up.
So you're looking at traffic accidents and EMS as well as fire.
So what we ask for is two sets of data. We ask for the dispatch data, or what we call CAD, the computer-aided dispatch, with timestamps for every call that the fire department's dispatched to, regardless of what nature of the call is. So it could be EMS, fire, the service call, whatever it may be. We also match that with the fire department's incident reporting data, which they should. In the perfect world, they line up together because every time you get dispatched from the dispatch center, there's going to be an incident report filed by the fire department. For some reason, various reasons, sometimes that doesn't line up exactly, but we're confident we can work with the material you have, the data that you have. Again, it's a small community. Last I remember, roughly 560 plus or minus calls annually, thereabouts, give or take. So we're not talking well into the thousands. So it'd be fairly easy for us to analyze it. What we do is we produce a series of maps. We're going to do dot maps or heat maps to show all calls. Where are they concentrated? Then we have other maps that break that out into structure fires, EMS calls, and so on and so forth. Hazmat and whatever. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I guess the reason for my question is that Bolton's a town that has more traffic accidents. We have some dangerous roads that go through town. So I think a lot, most of the resources, at least my sense of it is, most of the resources from the fire department are for that kind of call versus an actual structured fire. So that's very relevant, I feel, to the resources and budget of our department.
So, and that will be brought out in our analysis. I haven't looked at the data yet. We haven't received it yet. But my speculation is this, that Bolton is going to be reflective of the typical fire department across the country these days. Roughly 60%, 70% of that call volume is going to be non-fire EMS related. That's just the national trend. And that trend has gradually gone up and up and up, particularly since COVID, given the fact that there's been a greater demand for what used to be not considered emergency response, which is now emergency response, and usually it's medical assist. It doesn't hit the criteria for, code three emergency, if you will, high tier emergency, but it is a service that's provided. The dot maps or heat maps will really bring out what part of the town that's concentrated in. We'll also run tables and charts and what have you that will show you the nature of the call. Something that's important to understand that on a structured fire, let's say, if we look at the incident report from the fire department, you only had this many structured fires. But when you look at the dispatch data, the reported structured fires, it's kind of the boy who cried wolf. You can't take that risk. If they call in and say, there's smoke in my house, it's going to be a structured fire response. It may be this big, but the actual outcome may only be this. So you have to be very cognizant of that point so that you take this in consideration equally with what the outcome was.
And those incidents, where are the outcomes reported? Like how do you drive that out of the data?
Well, what we do is we take the data and specifically the nature of the call and the response times, dispatch time, arrival on the scene, things like that. Is that what you're asking?
No, so I'm saying if you were saying that, we were smoking the house, treating it as a structure fire, and then actually find out that structure fire takes up, of this 100% percentage, 10 to 15 or whatever of that. How do you is where does that information come to drive that 10%?
So on the dispatch side of the data, on the CAD data, you're going to be dispatched for a type of call. Let's say a reported structure fire. When the fire department gets on the scene and it turns out to be something other than an actual fire,
a blowback on a furnace.
A lot of times it's a furnace
right.
backfire.
Something like then that's going to be entered into the fire department's incident report. So we look at initial dispatch, what the nature of that call was versus what the actual outcome was. And we'll graph that side by side with bar graphs or whatever we do. So that of the 300 structure fires that you were dispatched to, only 82 of them, or whatever percentage was of that, was actual structure fire.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then I had a question on incident report too. When you were talking about them not overlapping, is what are some of the causes for that?
I got to think back to what that question were, that topic was when we talk about overlapping.
Your times, your
You were
dispatch
talking about the
time
timing of it.
and the call times. So when you're dispatched, you've got times on your dispatch, but sometimes
Traffic decrease.
the reported times in the incident
Oh,
management system are
yes.
different.
So,
And I'll give you a little more why that is it a human error that caused it, or is it like a just a system?
could be all the above, or it could just be human error. It could be how the dispatch center codes things versus how the fire department incident report uses codes. They're two separate systems, and they may not necessarily always line up. So I'll give you an example of one of the biggest challenges. So we use what's called, broadly speaking, response time. Now for us, response time is the time from the time that the dispatcher picks up the phone and Mrs. Smith is on the other end. help, 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 to the time the wheel, the first set of wheels stop on the curb. That's total or reflex time. That's a total time. Now that's divided in call processing, the dispatch time, which is when they're pushing buttons and they're announcing over the radio and speakers. All right, that's called turnout time, and then actual travel time. And that the travel time is the most critical piece. So we don't measure if a chief officer from the fire department arrives on the scene in their personal vehicle and they have a radio and they say, I'm on the scene. That's not when our clock stops, because the effectiveness of that individual in that private vehicle is marginal in terms of actually an outcome on the fire. So we're interested in when the emergency vehicle gets on the scene. Now, we're going to capture that information, but we're also going to point out that the actual first arriving unit got on the scene in 4 minutes, not the 2 minutes that the volunteer firefighter got on the scene in the personal vehicle. That's an important piece. Mm-hmm. It says, the fire department's got a representative on the scene, but the actual firefighting operations didn't take, or whatever the operations is, didn't take effect until that first unit got on the scene. So our challenge nationwide is a lack of consistency in terms of what the definition is of response time. So we use the national guide. We break it into those different pieces, and we try to at least. Sometimes the dispatch system, the CAD system, won't catch it. Sometimes because of staffing issues, especially a multi-agency or multi-discipline dispatch center, they do fire, EMS, and police. They're over here so busy doing whatever they're doing, they may not capture that time. Nowadays, with the newer technology, with mobile data terminals on fire engines and police cars, all they got to do is hit the button and the computer captures the time, instead of relying on someone to pick up a microphone and say we're on the scene and someone writing it down. So we haven't had a chance to even look at the system yet, which I think this week we are scheduled to tour the dispatch center.
That's tomorrow.
Okay.
So are you expecting any particular questions from us? Or is this like the Board of Selectmen interview? Or do we just want to keep drilling?
We can do both things. I did have a question of before the board, and that is, ultimately, in y'all's view, what do you want to really achieve in this study? We can address those three or four key things, but are there any other issues or viewpoints that you have in terms of the topic at hand?
I have a couple. Do you want me to?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, just two things that come to mind. Sort of a metric on budget versus the size of our fire department and the town. Some sort of metric that, I guess, given your position, you have vast knowledge of every, the whole country and averages. I'd be curious to know kind of where we sit in terms of what we spend on the fire department versus the national average or mean or, whatever.
I don't know if I'd go national average. You kind of have to stick to the Northeast.
That's a good point. Why?
I would just say the similar location.
Yeah, I'm just curious on what would lead you to.
I think it's a lot more expensive in Connecticut than it would be in Wyoming.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm just curious on where you were thinking. That's
per capita,
all. Yeah.
The whole nine.
I would also add that you could be two towns next to each other,
right,
and have very different issues, different challenges.
Sure.
A veteran community versus an old industrial northeastern city, as an example.
I think it would just be important to include that in the data. Yeah.
Now, what we have done, we have done what we call a comparative analysis, where we take like communities, either by the state or the region, whatever the criteria that y'all set, and then we do a questionnaire. We look at their service capabilities versus their risks, do a comparison. The challenge you have is, I'll give you an example where I once lived one time. The fire department was not mandatory to provide EMS. They didn't want to run EMS. And that's not uncommon in other parts of the state or the country. Matter of fact, it's more common than not in some states where there's no fire based EMS. They don't even respond what we call first responder, you know, in a small vehicle with one person, for a variety of reasons: politics, culture, law, legal, whatever. You can do what you're asking to do, but you have to be very careful in how you frame that so that you're getting real information, mm-hmm. valuable information. I can go back to that worst case scenario because, you know, the bedroom, let's say a Glendale, Arizona versus a Hartford, Connecticut, two very different environments. And I give you some really simple examples. Weather ultimately, overall, and on national, on an annual level, can have an impact on emergency services. You go to Glendale, Arizona, you don't have to worry about the weather out there, right? You don't have to worry about fire hydrants freezing, rust buildup on fire apparatus that runs up costs, prevented costs. I mean, there's a slew of things. But what you don't have here that they may have out west is the huge wildland fires that runs so long that the volunteer forces are just collapsed and they've got to make a living. They've got to go back to their community. So we always try to do a region and of like communities in terms of population density, area served, demographics, that sort of thing. And we can,
John, do you think there's like some useful results that could come with regard to what he's asking? Do you think there's something that we could get out of that? As in other words, comparing similar types of stations in the area to see if we're over budget or under budget, or just, I think that's what you're asking, right?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Just to get a,
is that possible? I don't even know if it's
possible. I would say it is possible. We'd like to talk to you a little bit more in depth about it and get some input from y'all, but that is certainly possible. Cool. Almost every project I've worked on in 20 plus years, it all boils down to the one main thing that we're here to talk about, and it's, can you afford a certain service or not?
Right.
I mean, the color of helmets and the color of fire trucks and all that kind of stuff is it has its place, but really ultimately that's what you're asking is, yep. is can you afford what
you... And my second question kind of dovetails with that. We've talked a little bit about eventually going or needing potentially some paid staff. So, you know, how does that chart out, in this mix too? So I'd be curious to maybe get some more insight. You know, you mentioned like looking out short term, medium term, long term. Yep. You know, that is something that we've talked about.
We would address that like all the other aspects of the study. And I'd be hesitant to even comment on that right now because I don't have enough facts in front of me. Some communities have felt that in a volunteer operation, based on whatever reason, usually because of call volume or maybe a burnout of the volunteer force, that they in some shape or form hire paid staff. That's not that uncommon. But I'd like to talk to you after we do our analysis. I'd like to talk to you all about that a little bit closer. And now you're changing the whole equation of your fire department. Now you're talking about a workforce that you have to be accountable to. Not to say that you're not accountable to the volunteer force. Don't get me wrong.
A lot of it's got to do with the volunteer staff that is not available during the day because they have full-time jobs.
Yep.
So
this is something that was brought up by the chief.
Okay.
Recently.
Okay.
The mutual aid thing comes in extremely handy at that point.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do we use that much during the week?
John and I we had the opportunity to chat a little bit before his 3 o'clock meeting today. And yeah, I'm happy to report that, I get every call. It comes over my phone. So I know what's happening in town. And the instances where we've had to call mutual aid because of a lack of response by our fire department have been very, very minimal in the last couple of years since you worked with the chief to institute that.
The new stipend system?
The new program where people are rewarded financially for coming to calls. That has made a difference. And I think, just the attitude of the leadership of the department that really embraces the people that join the department. And, we're not afraid to train them. We're not afraid to embrace them and make them part of it. It's more like a family there than it is, you know, an organization that is, you know, there to just do one thing. So they care about one another. They help one another. They serve one another as well as the entire community. So I think those things combined have really made a positive impact on our responses.
Mutual aid is a real lifesaver. We had a fire up the street, and what was it? 8 towns showed up. I mean, the town over showed up faster than we could.
Yeah,
they got a ton more equipment too.
Yeah. Well, there's one guarantee, and that is volunteer firefighters are always eager to exercise their firefighting capabilities.
So, yeah, you mentioned in the beginning of what you were saying that to try to keep your volunteer department as long as you can.
That's right.
I have a couple of questions.
Yeah.
I totally agree with what Rodney said earlier about focusing on the crash data on the 6 and 44 interchange, which you will probably, I hope your mind is blown when you visit that intersection tomorrow, because it's just unbelievable that that intersection has existed in that condition for so long. And I do think that if we have some data, that it will help us advocate to the state agencies to put money into redoing that whole intersection. Mm-hmm. So I agree with that. Totally agree with what Mather is saying, too, about having comparative information about the pace at which this town has purchased equipment, trucks, and how much we've been spending, because it's we hear from the public, I can't believe how many trucks we've purchased in the last, say, 10 years and at what cost. So I'd be very interested in both of those. I'm also interested in, I know that, I don't know what the current state of the zoning regulation is, but there is something in the zoning regs about having to have, are they called, what are the tanks called that you
have? Cisterns.
Cisterns. So if you would please look at that pretty carefully, because that is a huge expense.
Yes.
To people who are trying to build in town.
We've already discussed it starting this afternoon. Matter of fact, I had a discussion about that with Jim and the fire chief in recent weeks. I just received the ordinance this afternoon.
Okay, good. And I know that this was, I don't know, within the last 5 to 10 years, there was a position taken by, it might have been the former fire marshal, who felt that there needed to be a cistern or a water source within a certain number of feet of every single house in Bolton. And do you remember that, Jim? And there was a map that just showed, you know, dots all over the place, which would have been incredibly difficult, maybe impossible to even solve, that, you know, every single house had to be within a certain number of feet of a water source. So I'd love to see some thought about that. And then my last comment was, if you could also give your opinion in your report about the efficacy of the incentive program that our fire department has, and maybe you could give information about how those types of programs, either in Connecticut or New England, have worked, and whether there's, if ours is good enough, is it working? Because that really goes down to, that's a budget item too for us. So we have to look at it from the budgeting point of view.
Okay. Thank you for that input. Let me comment a little bit on the cistern and the, what we call dry hydrant. My hunch is, I don't know, the person's not here, they can't speak on this on their behalf, but typically, when we're talking about each house with a certain distance, that sounds like the 1,000 foot rule for reduced fire insurance rates. So I don't know. I haven't received the documents yet. I don't know where you stand as far as a town on ISO fire insurance rate. A class 10 is no recognized fire protection, in accordance to the ISO criteria. That means that most property owners, homeowners, and commercial properties have a very high rate. The more improvements you make in public fire protection on a scale of 1 to 10, theoretically at least, the lower you're going to go on that scale, the lower your insurance rates are going to be. Right now, any property that's not within 1,000 feet of a recognized water source in this town is probably going to get a class 10. I can't say that for sure, but probably a class 10. You're paying the highest insurance rate there is from your state. The incentive is to work your way back down, knowing you're never going to achieve probably class 1, because that would be an all-career fire department that would be well beyond the expense capability of the town. But for a town like this, it's not unusual for a town to be a class 6, a class 7. Again, I don't know what you are right now because I haven't seen those records. But the dry hydrant program, as I hear it, it sounds very much related to the ISO rule of 1,000 feet. What that means is, if I got a dry hydrant on the highway here, it can cover 1,000 feet this way and 1,000 feet that way. And those houses would be whatever the lower rating is. What they look at, your community fire defenses. Remember I said that word earlier, or term that, fire defense. So when they come in to rate you, they rate the fire department, the water system, if there is one, and emergency communications. And the fourth is fire prevention activities, fire marshal type stuff. The fire department is only 50% of that classification or rating. The water system is 40%. The emergency communications is 10%. If within the fire department, they're looking at, in your case, how many able-bodied firefighters do you, thank you very much, how do you have on staff? How many officers? What are their certifications and their training, the firefighter training? How often do you train as a group? And I'm glad to hear, I'm very encouraged from the fire chief that they have regular training weekly. Every Monday, they have some form of fire department training. We'll look at those regularly as well. Within the water department, they're looking at water reservoir, pumping stations, water mains, and fire hydrants, which we know does not exist here. So then what they say, well, we'll step back. Do you have alternative water sources? And if so, where are they and how are they maintained? That is dry hydrants. That's a pipe that goes down to the ground into a pond or a stream, but that has to be close to, so close to the road that the fire department, the fire truck can get to it with their big black hard suction hoses to draft water. Or some progressive communities have required, in conjunction with those dry hydrants, what you're calling cisterns, which is underground water tanks, or they could be above ground, doesn't matter. But they have to meet a certain design criteria and serviceability, and they have to be of a certain capacity. And that magic number for capacity is 30,000 gallons. And the reason why is because ISO says you got to be able to get recognized, you got to flow 250 gallons of water a minute for 2 hours. When you do that math, it comes up to 30,000 gallons. So they will recognize those. So if your fire department gets good credit, and your dispatch center gets good credit, and your fire marshal is doing their job, then you may get recognized. And I don't want to speak on behalf of ISO. I don't represent ISO, but you may receive credit for those cisterns, which will reduce insurance premiums for the life of the structure as long as it's being insured. So when we add up all the little savings of every little piece of property in town, commercial, residential, whatever the case may be, and you look at the cumulative savings in the community by improving fire protection, by lowering fire insurance rates, some towns see that as a benefit. Okay. But where do you cross? Where is that balance between investing in fire defenses and savings in fire insurance?
So there are, what, 2,000 houses? Town. So if they each save it $6, it's 12 grand a year you'd be picking up. So you want to save $50, then all of a sudden you're starting to.
Oh, I think it'd be more than that too.
I don't know what it'd be. So no, but nobody's ever really considering that.
So to sum up, we don't need them.
Need the
the cisterns.
Cisterns. That's a local decision.
Okay.
All right. No, now I will add one more thing to that. If you don't have the cisterns or the dry hydrants or what have you, and I agree with you to put one, to use the 1,000-foot rule, I mean, that would be a whole lot. The I've done the study, you know, of a, if it was a straight mile, straight run, was it 5280? Is that the number of feet? You do the every 2,000 feet type thing. You're talking an average about 3-point-something dry hydrants for every mile, linear mile. Okay. But don't fret yet, because if you can prove that you can do haul water, carry your water with you, and you can carry up to 4,000 gallons of water to the initial response, not 30 minutes from now, but on that initial response, which is critical, because so often people say, I had 50 volunteers on the scene over an hour and a half. But what about those first 5 minutes, which is the most critical? How many did you have on the scene then? So if you apply that same thought and you can produce 4,000 gallons of water, haul water, fire engine tankers, with your apparatus and your automatic aid apparatus, you might get credit. It's not going to be as much as a full class reduction, but you might get some benefit. Okay. We don't know what you are. We haven't seen a report yet. So we're anxious to see that and see exactly where you stand.
That'll be a fun result to see.
Yeah. And I think there's a variance too, where some of our communities are, you know, newer neighborhoods that are built with, like I'm thinking on just High Ridge Farm. I don't think that's a cistern, but that's just a dry.
No, there's a cistern. There's a cistern on High Ridge Farm that's 30,000 gallons. There's one on Tumblebrook that's 30,000 gallons.
And so those would be a three or something. And
I don't know if they get independent credit in the neighborhood.
Right. No.
I think it's a town rating.
Yeah, you are correct.
But when you buy a home, that's rated differently than two, or is that rated based off that town?
It's off the town.
Okay.
Now, if you are a major industry, if you are a major industry, I don't know, Acme Brick, and based on ISO's criteria or level of demand, you get rated separate from the town rating. Well, you're talking a huge industry,
right?
Your dwellings, typically insurance companies or the insurance industry is set up where it's a blanket rating for residential. And individual properties, like I'm talking about, get rated differently on that scale of 1 to 10. So let's say if your town is a class, I'm guessing, let's say a class 8, then anything that's within that 1,000 feet of that recognized water source and the fire department within 5 road miles from the fire department, you're going to get that town classification. That's something I didn't talk about, which we also map in our study. Yeah. We do a 5-mile road mile. And I'm going to guess you're such a small community, you're going to hit, I'd say 95% of your town's going to hit that 5 mile, mm-hmm. Within that 5 mile. So it's kind of a complex system, and I don't want to speak on behalf of ISO. It's something that we have mentioned in our proposal that y'all received, that we would consider factors within the ISO rating as it relates to in making improvements in staffing, facilities and equipment. Did I help?
Yeah, thank you.
John, I feel very enlightened by your talk. I want to ask you, will we have a chance to look at a draft of your report? A draft?
Draft of your report? And that would be up to the board and how you want to
the board.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I thought that we were talking to the public here. I apologize. Yes, you will receive at least 3 documents from us. You will receive the document, what we call preliminary findings, and then based on that and input and feedback from the board, then we go to the next step and write a draft. Document, a draft, a final report or plan, if you will, Once that's been approved, then we finalize it to the final. We come back and give our presentation with all of our recommendations and so forth.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Bob to Petro, by the way.
Okay. So, all right.
John, I'd be just curious, subjectively, how this morale is over there. Are we understaffed? Are they burnt out? Are we in a good spot? We need to really do a lot of more promotion. I do hate when people just say, people don't want to volunteer, because I feel like if you ask people, they will step up.
Right.
So do we need to do more reach out?
Yeah. And that's an excellent point. And that's high on our list. Later this week, when we get set down and we interview the chief officers and then the membership as a whole, we've asked to interview the chief himself individually, and we wanted to interview the body of the chief officers, the membership, and also the auxiliary, the fire department auxiliary. We think they play a role, have some input into the success of the fire department.
Thank you.
They do have a lot of pride over there, I think.
I'm proud of anyone that steps up for that.
They empty position. Out that,
and they should be proud too.
They empty out that place, and they have the Easter Bunny picnic or breakfast, and the 9/11 memorials, and they're always
good
on top of things.
The community.
So that 80. Does anybody have any other questions? No. The interchange that you're going to look at, just keep in mind that UConn's up the street, and there's a lot of traffic that goes through there.
And 3, 4, 5 times a year when people are coming back to campus from holidays, it is a busy intersection.
Right.
Game nights. It's...
Yep, that's true. Yeah, game nights are quite as busy as the move-ins, but there's certainly no slouch.
Well, something you might want to consider in addition to our data. Wait a minute. You don't have an actual police force. You're in a contract with the state police.
Yeah.
I was going to say that you often can relate their incident reports as well in terms of vehicle accident investigations.
Yeah, UConn maintains a database of crash data. Fortunately, there are actually not a lot of accidents there at those intersections. They tend to be just east of that or just west of that, but really not many vehicular incidents at that intersection.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
So an accident on 44, it can create havoc because the traffic is not diverted all over the place.
Sure. Yeah.
The lack of data specific to that intersection has been cited before for reasons why they won't look at it. If you're on Route 6 just around the corner, even a mile down into Andover, even though it's caused by the high speeds coming off the highway, nothing gets done about that intersection in particular.
I think that's all I have, unless y'all have any other questions.
Thank you, sir.
We're just glad to be here, offer you this service. If you have my contact information, if there's ever a time you need to discuss something else related to the project, just let me know.
We have a question from Andrea. Isn't she the board clerk?
Yes.
Yes, Andrea.
Hi. I was wondering if the gentleman from Manitou could spell his first and last name for the record.
Sure. It's John, J-O-H-N,
mm-hmm.
Cochran, C-O-C-H. R-A-N.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
How long will you be here in town, Don?
Through at least Friday, but depending on how things go on Wednesday, Thursday. I'm sorry, Thursday, Friday. It may be we're holding over till Saturday morning. I have a 2-hour drive. My partner is coming up from Maryland. Got a little bit farther to go.
So as you might know, we're working on bringing water up 44, but that's a little ways in the works. Manchester was trying to confirm their capacity.
Right.
They're pretty big area, and they were going to be doing some kind of fracking to their wells to get better production out of it. And so they said it was going to be a year or something to get last my last conversation. So,
well, We've been made aware of that issue. Of course, that's the first thing I asked before I even spoke to anybody was, where's the water? And found out that, you know, stops basically at the town line.
We got gas and sewer.
Any, any federal money for fire safety reasons for getting water in the town?
I don't know, because that's outside my realm. But I do know that small, actually, you might qualify because you are a small, you're less than 20,000. I think that's the magic number for some HUD-related funds.
Hmm.
I can't remember what the community development funds or something like that. I can't really speak to that. No, if water is ever, municipal water is ever expanded into your town, regardless of where it is only, it's just, it's obviously a benefit to the community. And again, we're not here to speak on ISO, but it can have a difference there.
It could be an increase in the population too, though.
Well, that's true. You know, I say this only incidental to our work that, you know, typically that drives new development. Right. Water and sewer can drive new development expansion. The way the laws in New England are set up, they're a little different from where I come from, where annexation, but you're landlocked. All your towns are already established, whereas, you know, southern states, it's a county open land, and then you have a town, and it has a city boundary. And here's another town, and they're racing each other who can annex the farthest into the open land, and that brings development. Some places, you know, you cannot get a building permit unless you have municipal water or you provide some alternate means of water for mineral criteria. Other places, you know, obviously here, that's not so much of an issue.
We took a cow path and paved it. Called it a road.
We have our cow path too.
That's actually something I was curious about. Thank you for bringing that up. John, I'd be curious to know if there's any impact with regard to our services we need to provide if we were to increase, if there were to be developments as a result of the water that we bring in. So if we put 50, 100, 200 units in, is there an impact that you would typically, and you don't have to answer if you don't know now, but I'd be curious to see if that would cost money. Is it?
I'll just speculate. What happens, it depends on what type of construction it is. What the demographics are. If you put in a 100-track housing development, at any given time, it may have a very low impact on services. New housing, new building stock, they don't have as many fires. The demographics typically are people who may not necessarily demand the need for EMS services as much as others.
Mm.
Versus a 4 or 5 story housing development or a healthcare facility, something that is going to drive the call for services. The other aspect is, are they within the defined response boundary, the acceptable benchmarking that you've asked us to look at, whether it be distance or time. If it's still within the acceptable time, that's not so much of a problem. Because you're already covering that area. But now if you get out here and on the outskirts of a town and it's beyond your designated response boundary, now that could impact. It could impact from the ISO insurance perspective. It could impact from your benchmarking. I always bring up ISO because it for 110 years, that criteria has driven a lot of public policy decisions on fire protection.
Gotcha.
Big cities and small. At one time, it was the only criteria out there. And now that has been overshadowed by newer, different kinds of criteria. But it still exists. It still has an impact on the community.
Well, I think the biggest area that we have for possible development is on Route 44.
Some are primarily commercial or
probably pretty easy
or,
to get to.
Residential, high density residential,
something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we prefer commercial.
Yeah.
But that would require water towers and stuff like that.
Sure. You got to do the cost benefit analysis.
Well, we need residential as well because of the school population.
Yeah. When I interviewed, I interviewed the building official, community development and zoning. Is that right? This afternoon.
Yes.
And you know, their input was that to some degree the town demographic is aging. And the population is either holding its own or might even have a trend to go down.
The school population is.
Okay.
I don't know about the overall.
That really surprised me, considering you're right next to Manchester. Typically, the bedroom communities, the suburban sprawl rings, and so forth. It often drives more development, more growth, but you don't have the water and sewer or gas, I guess, that maybe part of the ingredient
space. I don't think we have a lot of lots left.
Don't either. Yeah.
So just to wrap this up, those three major things that we've been tasked to look at, which is the fire department and its organization, its staffing, its equipment, and its facilities. That's our main focus. But we're here to assist you any way we can in terms of identifying any other issues that we need to address.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Meeting adjourned?
Oh, well. We're going to end the meeting.
Is someone going to?
I would make a motion that we adjourn.
I second that motion.
Thank you, favor.
Aye.
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 That was motion by Tim, second by Bryce.
That's a seven. Thank yes. You. Meeting adjourned. Aye. Thank you, Bob.
I'm hungry.
Well, come on up and have a
sandwich. We got food here.
I was going to say, Bob, I'll make you one.
You might be talking about the time to make it down to his house.
Bob, we're going to end the meeting now, but you've got the Zoom link for the next meeting, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We'll see you in a little bit.
Okay.
Mather, lead the way to the same.